You're listening to episode 553 of Unwelcome Guests. We continue with Noam Chomsky, speaking from May 2011 on what drives U.S. foreign policy.
The country was in a deep recession when Obama came in. The first task was to create a commission, economic commission, to try to find the way out of the recession. If you take a look at who was on it, he was very careful to exclude all critics of the policies that led to the recession, including Nobel laureates, and picked the people who designed the policies that created the recession, almost without exception. And there was a result. I'll read you the version of the result that was just produced by the special inspector for government special inspector for the bailout program, Neil Barofsky. He points out that there was a legislative act that authorized the bailout, and it was a bargain. The bargain was that the financial institutions that created the crisis would be saved by the taxpayer, and the victims of their misdeeds would be somewhat compensated by measures to protect home values and preserve home ownership. The core of the recession was an $8 trillion housing bubble that collapsed, leaving people with no homes and no capital. Well, he goes on to say that only the first part of the bargain was kept. The financial institutions were rewarded lavishly for causing the crisis and forgiven for outright crimes, but as he puts it, the rest of the program floundered. Foreclosures continued to mount, with 8 million to 13 million filings forecast over the program's lifetime, while the biggest banks are 20% larger than they were before the crisis and control a larger part of our economy than ever. They reasonably assume that the government, meaning the taxpayer, will rescue them again if necessary. Indeed, credit rating agencies incorporate future government bailouts into their assessments of the largest banks, exaggerating market distortions that provide them with an unfair advantage over smaller institutions, which continue to struggle, and of course encouraging them to undertake risky transactions with a big profit, because when it collapses, as it will, the taxpayer will come and bail them out. So in short, Barofsky concludes, Obama's programs were a giveaway to Wall Street executives and a blow in the solar plexus to their defenseless victims, all in accord with Adam Smith's maxim from the 1770s. And it's pretty much the same on foreign policy. So let's pick a few critical moments for formation of foreign policy. The global system changed radically during World War II. The United States emerged from the Second World War as overwhelmingly the most powerful state in the world, richest, most powerful, and it expected to make use of that power to organize the world in the interests of the domestic masters of mankind. During the Second World War, President Roosevelt's planners, State Department planners, experts in foreign policy from outside, had regular meetings in which they planned for the post-war world. They knew that the United States was going to replace Britain as the global dominant power, and they wanted to lay out plans to what the world would look like. Well, there's one of the leading British diplomatic historians, Geoffrey Warner, recently pointed out after a study of this, that from the documentary record, it's perfectly clear that President Roosevelt was aiming at United States hegemony in the post-war world, and not surprising given U.S. power. And they had specific plans. They planned to construct what they called a grand area, which would be under U.S. control. That would include the entire Western Hemisphere, the Far East, and the former British Empire, including, crucially, the Middle East energy reserves. That's the minimum. The maximum would be as much as possible. Certainly, the core of Eurasia, the economic industrial core of Eurasia, Western Europe. Well, that was the grand area. And in the grand area, I'm quoting, the United States will maintain unquestioned power with military and economic supremacy while ensuring the limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that might interfere with its global designs. And more significant, the wartime plans were soon implemented. Now, this ought to be sort of the first week of a freshman course in college on post-war foreign policy. It's very significant. And that's remained, that stays the policy. And it's often stated pretty forthrightly. So take, say, Bill Clinton, sort of on the less aggressive side. His doctrine presented to Congress was that the United States has the right to use military force unilaterally to ensure uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources, and the U.S. must maintain military forces forward deployed in Europe and Asia in order to shape people's opinions about us, not by persuasion, and to shape events that will affect our livelihood and our security in that special sense of security. Well, that doctrine licenses military intervention at will, and it actually goes well beyond the much reviled George W. Bush doctrine, which at least required pretexts for intervention. For Clinton, you didn't need any pretexts, just controlling the grand area. But Clinton's doctrine was presented politely, and so it received no censure, unlike the brazen and arrogant pronouncements of his successor. It's style that matters, not content. The content remains pretty much the same. Well, take the invasion of Iraq, which is quite interesting if you look at it closely. Throughout the course of the invasion, it became clearer that the U.S. was going to fail. It was not going to achieve its objectives. And as the failure became clear, the actual goals of the invasion could no longer be concealed with the usual pretty rhetoric. And they were expressed, not reported, but expressed by the government. So in November 2007, the Bush administration produced a declaration of principles. Here's the way it's got to work. United States forces must remain indefinitely in Iraq, and Iraq must privilege American investors. 2 months later, in January 2008, Bush informed Congress that he would reject any legislation that might limit the permanent stationing of U.S. armed forces in Iraq or U.S. control of the oil resources of Iraq. Pretty straight, standard. Grand Area Doctrine. These are incidentally demands that the United States had to abandon shortly after in the face of Iraqi resistance, which was another step in a major defeat. Well, it's the same World War II principles hold for what's now considered to be the greatest danger to world order, and in fact is considered the leading foreign policy issue for the United States. That's the Iranian threat. Last year was the year of Iran because of this terrible Iranian threat. Well, what exactly is the Iranian threat? It's something rarely discussed, but there actually is an authoritative answer. It was given by the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence in their annual report to Congress on the global security situation. Highest possible source. They point out that the Iranian threat, which they take to be very severe, is not a military threat. In fact, Iranian military spending is low even by the standards of the region and minuscule fraction of U.S. spending. Furthermore, Iran, they say, has limited capacity to deploy forces abroad. And then they look into its strategic doctrine, its military doctrine, and they say the military doctrine is defensive. It's designed to deter an invasion long enough so that diplomacy can set in. Well, they, of course, discuss the nuclear threat, and they say that if Iran is trying to develop a nuclear capability, that would be part of their deterrence strategy. Okay, that's the military side of the threat. However, it's a very severe threat. One, because deterrence violates grand area principles. Remember, the basic principle is that no interference with U.S. actions is to be tolerated. And if a country can deter an invasion or can deter aggressive action, that's an interference with our right to dominate the world. So that's a threat. And there's another threat, which they point out. That's what they call Iran's efforts to destabilize the region. How is Iran destabilizing the region? Well, by trying to develop, to extend its influence into neighboring countries, by Iraq and Afghanistan, by extending commercial relations, cultural relations, and so on. And that destabilizes the country. In contrast, when we invade those countries and half destroy them, that stabilizes the region. And this is normal practice. This is the normal usage of the term stability. It's used that way all the time, sometimes so extreme it's hard to believe. So, for example, when the U.S. Overthrew the parliamentary government in Chile and installed a vicious dictatorship, this action was criticized by the leading foreign policy analysts, James Chase for one, but he said nevertheless it was necessary to destabilize Chile in order to impose stability. And that's not a contradiction if you understand the technical meaning of the words. Stability means we run it, we own the world, anything that interferes is destabilizing. That's unchallenged at home, of course, but not in the rest of the world. And that's significant, because over the years, the U.S. capacity to implement grand area strategy has declined. The strategy is the same, the rhetoric's about the same, but the capacity to implement it has declined, and for good reasons. The peak of U.S. power in the world was right after World War II. The United States literally had half the world's wealth. That's unheard of, a position of overwhelming military power. Its industrial competitors were either destroyed or severely weakened. And at that point, the ability to implement policy was simply overwhelming. Well, that changed through decolonization, reconstruction of the industrial societies. U.S. share of global power declined, remained enormous, but it declined by, say, 1970. It was maybe 25% of the world's wealth, still colossal, but not half. By that time, the world was becoming what was called tripolar, three major industrial centers. One was North America, based in the United States. Another, Europe, now recovered, primarily based in Germany. And the third was East Asia, at that point Japan-based. And now it's the world's most dynamic industrial region. China is the core of it in a certain sense, but it's worth to remember that China is an assembly plant. The more advanced technology, fancy software and parts and components, they mostly come from the industrial societies on the periphery of China, Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan, and also from the United States. And they're sent to China to assemble. If you take a look at, say, the trade, a lot of talk about the trade deficit with China. However, if you calculate that trade deficit correctly in terms of what's called the value added in China to what you purchase, say if you purchase an iPod, how much of the value is actually added in China, turns out that the trade deficit with China is overestimated by about 25%, and it's underestimated with Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan by roughly the same. So yes, it's a growing important country, but it's really the industrial region that's growing. Well, the let's take a look at Latin America. In grand area strategy, it was just taken for granted that we control Latin America, period. It's our backyard. Henry Stimson, Secretary of War under Roosevelt, described it as our little region over here, which has never bothered anybody. That's as he was working to ensure that other regional alliances all over the world would be dismantled while our own would be strengthened. Go on to say the early 70s, Richard Nixon, at the time when the Nixon administration was planning the destabilization of Chile in order to impose stability. At that time, the National Security Council, the highest planning body, pointed out that if we don't control Latin America, how are we going to control the rest of the world? That's the easy one. So we better make sure we control Latin America. Well, that's changed. In the last 10 years, South America, for the first time in half a millennium since the European explorers came, South America has begun to move towards independence, towards integration, countries integrating with one another, prerequisite for independence, and also towards addressing some of their horrendous internal problems. By now, the United States has been kicked out of every military base in Latin America and South America. That's quite a change. The Bush and Obama administrations had hoped to maintain a couple of bases in Colombia, the one country that's more or less under control. But the Colombian Constitutional Court has so far blocked it. Actually, the one remaining major military base in the continent outside of North America is in Honduras. And very likely that's a large part of the reason why Obama broke with Latin America and, in fact, with most of the world by supporting the military coup in Honduras, leaving a highly repressive and brutal regime, but with the military base intact. Well, last February a year ago, a new organization was formed, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC. It included all states of the hemisphere apart from the U.S. and Canada. Now, anything like that was just unthinkable in earlier years. Now, they're going to have their first meeting in July, and it'll be worth keeping an eye on it. If that functions, that's a harsh blow to U.S. domination of its traditional backyard. Well, control of Latin America was regarded from the very beginning as central to grand area doctrine, and in fact, it was way beyond, back to the Monroe Doctrine. But it was nowhere near as crucial as control of the vast energy resources of the Middle East, what President Eisenhower called the most strategically important area of the world. The State Department described it as a stupendous source of strategic power, probably the richest economic prize in the world in the field of foreign investment. And that was a prize that, of course, the U.S. intended to keep for itself and its allies in the unfolding New World Order after the Second World War. Well, despite changes, and there have been plenty, planners still adhere to the doctrine that was expressed shortly after the war by one of Roosevelt's leading advisors, A.A. Burley, who pointed out that if we can control Middle East energy resources, we will have substantial control of the world. It's not a small issue, and it follows that loss of that control would threaten the whole project of global dominance that was clearly articulated during World War II and has been implemented and sustained to the extent possible since that day, despite major changes in world order. Well, right now that's threatened. That's the significance of what was happening. It's been happening for the last couple of months in the Arab world. A spectacular a display of courage, dedication, commitment by popular forces. Outcome's uncertain, but a lot has been achieved. And this is extremely threatening to the United States, because it's threatening to bring democracy. And democracy, if it means anything, it means that the will of the population has some effect on policy, not just the masters. And that's really a threat domestically, too. And we know what the will of the population, we know a lot about what the will of the population is. Now, it's not reported. I mean, it's known, but not reported. But it's obviously known to planners. Now, there are studies carried out by the major U.S. Polling agencies. They're released by prestigious institutions like the Brookings Institute in Washington. And they're very, very striking. So take Egypt, the most important country. In Egypt, 90% of the population regard the United States as the major threat to their interest. In fact, they're so critical of U.S. policy that about 80% think the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons to counter U.S.-Israeli domination. And the figures are a very small percentage, maybe 10% in the region think of Iran as a threat. Well, the figures vary from country to country, but roughly like that. Well, as I say, it's not reported. There's not a single report in the United States in the mainstream. You can find it at the edges. But obviously, planners know all about it. Well, there's a principle behind it. The principle was expressed quite accurately by the head of the Carnegie Endowment Middle East Research Program, the former high Jordanian official, Marwan Muasher. What he pointed out is that as long as the populations are under control and they are passive and apathetic, then the powerful can do what they like. So therefore, it's fine to disregard public opinion until they get out of control, which is what's happening now. Now, that's an old principle. And again, if the media, schools, the universities were doing their job, everyone would know what I'm going to say, because it's quite old and important. Go back to, say, 1958, President Eisenhower. The President Eisenhower was concerned about public opinion in the Arab world. He was concerned about what he called a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, and not by the governments, which are more or less under control, but by the people. And in that same year, the National Security Council produced a memorandum, long declassified, which gave the reasons. It said there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports harsh and brutal dictatorships, and that we oppose democracy and development, and we do it because we want to maintain control over their energy resources. And it went on to say that this perception is more or less accurate, and furthermore, that's what we ought to be doing on the operative principles of foreign policy and world order. So as long as the Muasher Doctrine holds, populations are controlled, we don't care if there's a campaign of hatred. We'll go on and control their resources and support democracies and dictatorships and block democracy and development. Well, let's move on to George Bush number two. After 9/11, as you'll recall, he gave a kind of a plaintive speech in which he asked, why do they hate us? And he concluded that they hate our freedom. Right after that, the Pentagon initiated a research study and Science Board, which concluded, responded to him, he said, no, they don't hate our freedom, they hate our policies. And it was essentially a repetition of what the National Security Council had said in 1958. They didn't add what we should conclude. It's not that they hate our freedom, it's that we hate their freedom. And there's a good reason, because if they're free, they're going to follow the policies, the will of the population. And that means the U.S. is just going to be driven out of the region. That's obvious from the campaign of hatred in 58 and everything since, and the contemporary polls. We saw pretty dramatic demonstration of how educated elite opinion interprets that right now. Kind of striking that there wasn't any commentary on it. You've all followed WikiLeaks, I'm sure. The most of the WikiLeaks exposures, the one that received most attention in the headlines, you know, with enthusiastic commentary and so on, was that the Arabs support U.S. policy on Iran, Iran being the main threat to the world. Well, that's true of the Arab dictators, which is all they cared about, but it's dramatically false for the population. The population, on the contrary, strongly opposes U.S. policy and even calls for Iran to have nuclear weapons. However, as long as the Muasher doctrine holds, you know, you keep the population under control, who cares? All educated opinion cares about is the dictators. And as long as they're supporting us, we don't care about the population. It was very clearly illustrated. But it is a problem, and you can see it right in front of your eyes, day after day. Egypt is still under military rule. There hasn't been a real large-scale social and political change, but there have been changes. And the new Egyptian government is more responsive to the popular will, and things are happening that are considered extremely threatening in the United States. There's good reasons why we oppose democracy. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, the Egyptians permitted Iranian ships to go through the Suez Canal for the first time in 30 years, breaking the U.S. policy of isolation. Just a couple of weeks ago, a couple of days ago, in fact, Egypt organized a unification agreement between the two major Palestinian factions, Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank. Now, that again is a very, Israel reacted very harshly, the U.S. did too, and for good reasons. For about 20 years, a major U.S.-Israeli policy has been to separate Gaza from the West Bank. It's in violation of the Oslo agreements, 1993, which describe them as a territorial unity, but, you know, that was the policy, and it's been pretty successful. But the unification agreement, if it holds, might overcome that. Furthermore, unification might make it easier, might ease the way towards diplomatic negotiations for a political settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict. That's been one of the ways of holding that off has been to claim that the Palestinians, you know, aren't a partner for peace. Well, if you look at the record, again, this doesn't get reported, but it's easy to discover. For 35 years, the United States has unilaterally been blocking a political settlement. It's alone in the world on this, along with Israel. You can see it in Security Council votes, vetoes, General Assembly resolutions, public statements, and so on. And in fact, if the unification agreement facilitates the path towards negotiations, U.S. and Israeli isolation is going to become so dramatic that it's going to be hard even for the press not to report it. Well, that's, and certainly most of the rest of the world understands, so that's dangerous. The New York Times warned about something else, which they are concerned about very much, namely the 1979 peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. The Times reported the concerns in Washington that treaty might be threatened. It's very unpopular among Egyptians. And the treaty, they said, is a cornerstone of the region's stability. Well, there's that nice word, stability, again. Actually, the peace treaty is actually a cornerstone of the region's instability. Very dramatically, when the peace treaty was signed in 1979, there's an interesting history which I won't go into, but when it was signed, Israel responded rationally. They concluded that Egypt, which is the main deterrent to Israeli actions, only major military force in the Arab world. So with Egypt neutralized, Israel could move ahead much more freely towards integrating the occupied territories to the extent, taking them over to the extent that it wanted, all illegal, of course, and also by attacking its northern neighbor, Lebanon, which they proceeded to do right away. Major attack, killing tens of thousands of people. Well, that's instability in the normal meaning of the word, but it's stability in the technical meaning, because it accords with U.S. plans. So that's why the treaty is called a cornerstone of the region's stability, kind of like Iran. Well, check the U.S. reaction to the democracy uprising, and you can see all this playing out very straightforwardly. Major principle is democracy is a real threat, so we've got to do something to deter it. Well, there are several categories of states. The most important are the oil-rich states, where the dictators are reliable and obedient, like, say, Saudi Arabia. Well, there they're given free rein to crush the demonstrations, because we want to keep things the way they are. Saudi Arabia, for example, there was an effort to join the democracy uprisings, but security presence was so overwhelming that people were afraid even to go out in the streets. Okay, no comment about that. The same thing happened in Kuwait, also a reliable dictator. The most interesting case is Bahrain. Bahrain isn't all that important in itself, except that it hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which is the major military force in the region. But crucially, Bahrain is just a couple of miles from Saudi Arabia off the coast. It has a majority Shiite population. Eastern Saudi Arabia, right next door, is also majority Shiite. They both have Sunni dictatorships. And that happens to be where most of Saudi oil is. So there's a deep concern that the major oil resources in the region, eastern Saudi Arabia, southern Iraq, southwestern Iran, all mostly Shiite, might fall under Shiite control, which might move towards independence. So therefore, any democracy movement in Bahrain has to be crushed, and it has been crushed violently. There was a Saudi-led military invasion, gave the Bahraini security forces the capacity to, destroy the 10th cities, destroy their version of Tahrir Square, Pearl Square, break into the hospitals, empty the hospitals, throw out the doctors and the patients, torture human rights activists. It's a real horror story going on right now, destroying Shiite mosques, all kinds of atrocities. Virtually no comment. That's necessary to keep for the stability of the reliable, obedient, oil-rich dictators. Well, take the countries that had dictators but not a lot of oil. So, for example, Egypt and Tunisia. Well, in those cases, the U.S. followed a very standard game plan. You have to be kind of blind not to see it. Over and over again through the years, some favored dictator gets into trouble. And the procedure is always the same. Say, Somoza in Nicaragua, or Marcos in the Philippines, Chun in South Korea, Mobutu in the Congo, Suharto in Indonesia, case after case. What you do is support him as long as possible, and if it becomes impossible to support him, like for example if the army turns against him, then shelve him, send him away somewhere, and try to restore the old regime as much as possible, maybe with new names. It's exactly what's going on in Egypt and in Tunisia. Right in front of our eyes, very familiar pattern. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but that's the policy. Well, that leaves one other category, an oil-rich dictator who isn't reliable, and there is such a case. That's Libya. And here's what the U.S. has done, and Britain, that worked together, is very striking. They've strongly supported Gaddafi. I don't have time to go into the details if you like, but up till the present, they've been very strongly supporting him. But now there's a chance to get rid of him. So that's what they're trying to do, just on before I came over here, I was listening, watching BBC on television, and they're perfectly frank about it. The reporting says, yeah, we support the rebels. That's what we're doing. The head of NATO was interviewed, and he said, well, you know, it's justified because the regional powers asked us to, the Arab League. It's kind of a half-truth, at least. The Arab League did call for a no-fly zone, but it immediately retracted as soon as it saw that the US, Britain, and France were going way beyond the resolution to protect civilians and were just joining in the rebellion. There's another small point. At the same time that the Arab League called for a no-fly zone over Libya, it also called for a no-fly zone over Gaza to prevent further US-Israeli attacks on Gaza, which devastated the place. That literally didn't get reported in the United States, except way out at the margins. You can read about it in the international business press. We don't have to adhere to that call because it doesn't accord with our goals. In Libya, the actual intervention, I mean, you can say it's right, you can say it's wrong, but at least we ought to be honest about what it is. It's direct intervention on the side of the rebels, as not protecting civilians, just try to see if our side can win. The intervention is carried out by France, Britain, and the United States. Note that those are the three traditional imperial powers. They're doing it in virtual isolation. There's token participation by NATO, very little. In the Arab world, where there's huge military forces, in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, nothing. They don't want to be involved. A couple of reconnaissance planes from Qatar. It's an African country. The African Union's calling for diplomacy. They don't want to be involved. They don't want the intervention. The major regional power, Turkey, also a huge military force in NATO. They're not trying to impose any no-fly zone. They don't have anything to do with it. The so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the main emerging countries, it's most of the world, they just completed a conference in China, and they came out with a declaration opposing any military force in Libya and calling for negotiations and diplomacy. Well, again, you can have whatever opinion you like, but the facts are quite clear. The imperial triumvirate is isolated. They are acting alone. It's another sign of the decline in the capacity to rule the world, just getting more free and open. And the same is true in the case of Iran. The United States is extremely isolated on that. The non-aligned countries, that's most of the world, they've been supporting Iran's right to enrich uranium vigorously from the beginning. Well, we don't care about them. The region, I've already mentioned, in the region, public opinion overwhelmingly supports not only Iran's right to develop nuclear energy, but even to have nuclear weapons. Well, the Muasher Doctrine tells us we can ignore the regional population. The same is true of Turkey, major power, which is nothing to do with the isolation. In fact, they're increasing commercial relations with Iran. Same is true of Brazil, the most respected country in the South. Well, the United States can tolerate Turkish and Brazilian disobedience, though with some dismay, but there's another country that's harder to ignore. That's China. The press warns that China's investors and traders are now filling a vacuum in Iran as businesses from other countries, mainly Europe, pull out in response to U.S. demands. And in particular, China's expanding its dominant role in Iran's energy industries. And Washington not only doesn't like it, but it's reacting with a touch of real desperation. So the State Department recently warned China that if it wants to be accepted in the international community, meaning by the U.S., then it must, I'm quoting, skirt and evade international responsibilities, which are clear. And what are the international responsibilities? Well, to follow U.S. orders. China does observe UN sanctions, because they're mostly toothless, and they're criticized here for that, but they're not following unilateral US sanctions, and therefore they're not meeting their international responsibilities. This just elicits laughter in the Chinese Foreign Office. Now, the real threat of China is they just can't be intimidated. And their picture is, look, we've been around for 3,000 years, the major civilization in the world. We've been fending off the barbarians. We don't care about them now. And that's frightening. I mean, if you're the mafia don and people stop following orders, you're in serious trouble. So that's the main threat of China. Now, there's also talk about a military threat. And in fact, the Pentagon just released a study of it. They say that China's military budget is approaching one-fifth of what the Pentagon spent to operate and carry out the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. A small fraction of U.S. military spending, which is roughly the same as the world combined. The New York Times reported that China's expansion of military forces might deny the ability of American warships to operate in international waters off China's coast. What about international waters off the U.S. coast, like, say, in the Caribbean? See the Chinese Navy deploying there? Just imagine what would happen if they did. The strategic analysis literature is quite interesting, the technical literature. It speaks of a classic security dilemma in the U.S.-China confrontation. Each side regards its primary interests at stake. So China's interests are the territorial, the waters right near its border. And our interest is the waters right near China's border. That's a classic security dilemma, and that's hard to deal with, and of course makes sense if the U.S. controls most of the world. You look at the intellectual journals, like the New Republic recently expressed its concern about the fact that China sent 10 warships through international waters just off the Japanese island of Okinawa, which indeed is a provocation, unlike the fact, which they don't mention, that Washington long ago converted the island into a major military base in defiance of the vehement protests of the people of Okinawa. But that's not a provocation on the standard principle that we own the world. Well, actually, there is good reason for China's neighbors to be concerned about its growing military and commercial clout, and in the Middle East, although Arab public opinion supports an Iranian nuclear weapons program, we certainly shouldn't do so. We should try to do something to reduce or eliminate the nuclear weapons program, not only Iran, but everywhere. Foreign policy literature is full of suggestions, but there's one that's missing, the one that can work, namely move to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Here's another case where the U.S. is almost totally isolated. There are regular review sessions of the non-proliferation treaty. The latest was about a year ago. International support for a nuclear weapons-free zone was so overwhelming that Obama had to formally agree. However, he insisted that there be a qualification, namely Israel has to be exempted. And of course the U.S. is self-exempted from all international obligations. Important fact, not discussed. So what he said is, it's a fine idea, but this isn't the time. And furthermore, the U.S. insisted no proposal can call for Israel's nuclear program to be placed under the auspices of the International Atomic Energy Agency, or can call for release of information about Israeli nuclear facilities and activities, including information pertaining to previous nuclear transfers to Israel. End of nuclear weapons-free zone. Well, these policies can persist as long as we obey here the Muasher Doctrine. As long as we don't do anything about it, yeah, then we can face the possibility of an Iranian nuclear threat in a very volatile region, although there is a solution. Actually, it's rarely noted, in fact, almost never, that the US and Britain have a special responsibility to move to a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. There's a very good reason for that. When the US and Britain invaded Iraq, they tried to construct a legal cover, pretty thin legal cover, which fell apart pretty soon. The cover was that Iran, you'll recall, I'm sure, Iraq was developing weapons of mass destruction, and it was therefore violating a Security Council resolution of 1991, which called on them to eliminate their WMD programs. Well, we know the fate of that, but putting that aside, if you go back and look at that Security Council resolution, it committed the signers to work to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. So the US and Britain, above all other countries, have a special responsibility for this. And US isolation in blocking it is a serious threat to the world and shouldn't be tolerated, but that's up to us. Nobody else can do anything. Well, I mentioned that the doctrines, the hegemonic doctrines that were formulated during World War II, they're still prevailing, at least in rhetoric, but the power to implement them is notably declining. Some of the major reasons are actually domestic. The American society now, for the last 30 years, is being quite consciously undermined by the masters of mankind at home. Since the 1970s, there's been a very sharp change in the economy. There's a move from production to financialization. Back at that time, financial institutions were a small fraction of the economy, and they're doing what they're supposed to do in a state capitalist economy. They were taking unused resources, like somebody's bank account, and transferring them to productive use. That's what they're for. That's gone. Since the 1970s, that's almost totally gone. By now, they're not a few percentage of the economy. By 2007, right before the crash that they created, they had 40% of corporate profits. And their activities have maybe no social utility, maybe harmful effects. They don't contribute to the health of society. They're ways of making tons of money by financial manipulation and trickery. Well, there's no time to go into the details, but if you look into it, there have been a variety of factors since the 1970s that have interacted, have kind of converged, to create a vicious cycle of radical concentration of wealth, which is mostly in the top fraction of 1% of the population. Now, that means CEOs, hedge fund managers, and so on. Such a small percentage of the population is not even captured by the census figures. You have to do careful analysis to find it. That's the main source of the extreme inequality. Well, then we go to Adam Smith's maxim. The concentration of economic power leads to concentration of political power, which in turn leads to state policies, government policies, that increase this concentration. Fiscal policies like taxation, like, say, when John Boehner says everything's on the table except raising taxes for the rich, things like, and there's plenty more like it, rules of corporate governance, deregulation, which is great for the financial institutions, leads to repeated crashes, and a lot more. So you have this vicious cycle. At the same time, part of it is that the costs of electoral campaigns are skyrocketing, which drives the political parties deeper into the pockets of concentration of capital, increasingly financial capital. And for the Republicans, just reflexive. For the Democrats, who incidentally are now what used to be called moderate Republicans, for them, they're not far behind. Well, while all this is going on, and income and wealth and power are becoming extremely narrowly concentrated, for most people, for the last 30 years, real incomes have pretty much stagnated. People have been getting by with increased work hours, way beyond Europe now, debt and asset inflation, like the housing bubble, which is regularly destroyed by the financial crises that began as soon as the regulatory apparatus began to be dismantled under Reagan. Now, none of this makes any difference. It's fine for the very wealthy, especially for the financial institutions, which are at the heart of it. They benefit from the government insurance policy that Neil Barofsky mentioned, what's called too big to fail. So what that means is the banks and the investment firms can make risky transactions. They get rich rewards. That happens with a risky transaction. And you can ignore what the economists call an externality, something that doesn't figure in market transactions. In this case, it's a systemic risk, the risk that the whole system will collapse if something goes wrong with your transaction. But that's a footnote. Forget about it. Well, inevitably, the system crashes. And then what they can do is run to the nanny state that they nurture and ask for a taxpayer bailout, clutching their copies of Hayek and Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand and so on. Now, that's been a regular process since the Reagan years. Each crisis is more extreme than the last, for the public, that is. Real unemployment in the country is at the level of the Great Depression for much of the population. Goldman Sachs, meanwhile, the main architects of the current crisis, they're richer than ever, bigger than ever, and they've just quietly announced $17.5 billion in compensation for last year, with CEO Lloyd Blankfein receiving a $12.5 million bonus and his base salary more than tripled. But we have to make sure that he doesn't get taxed, because that would harm jobs. You know? I won't talk about elections. They're just by now a charade run by the PR industry. Well, I've barely skimmed the surface of these critical issues, but I don't want to end without mentioning one more externality that is dismissed in market systems. That is the fate of the species. If you're the CEO of a corporation or an investment bank, that's something you don't take into account in market transactions. It's an institute, it's a fact about market systems. Well, systemic risk in the financial system, that can be remedied by the taxpayer, but nobody's going to come to the rescue if the environment's destroyed. And that, we should recognize, is close to an institutional imperative as things now stand. Business leaders... business leaders are quite openly declaring that they're conducting massive propaganda campaigns to convince the population that anthropogenic global warming, you know, human contributions to global warming, is just some kind of liberal hoax. Now, the people who are carrying out these campaigns, they understand perfectly well that the threat is very grave, but they have an institutional role. They have to maximize short-term profit. And if they don't, they'll be kicked out, and somebody else will come in who will do it. That's an institutional fact, not an individual one, which makes the problem much more severe. Now, this particular vicious cycle could well be lethal. And to just get a sense of how serious the threat is, it's really enough to have a look at the new Congress that came in, propelled into power by business funding and propaganda. Almost all are climate deniers. Now, they've already been cutting measures that might mitigate environmental catastrophe. Kind of one indication of how far the country has shifted to the far right is that they're basically trying, right now, one of the things they're trying to destroy is the Environmental Protection Agency. That was instituted under Richard Nixon, who was, in fact, the last liberal president, literally. Ever since then, it's gone to the right. Worse still, a number of them are really true believers. like the head of one of the newly elected Republican congressman, who's the head of one of the subcommittees on the environment, as you may have read, he explained that a global warming can't be a problem because God promised Noah that there wouldn't be another flood. Well, you know, if that was happening in some tiny country somewhere, we could laugh. But not when it's happening in the richest and most powerful country in the world. And before we laugh, we might also bear in mind that the current economic crisis is traceable in substantial measure to a fanatic faith in dogmas, such dogmas as the efficient market hypothesis, and in general to what Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz 15 years ago called the religion that markets know best. That made it unnecessary, the religious faith made it unnecessary to notice an $8 trillion housing bubble that had no basis whatsoever in economic fundamentals and devastated the economy when it inevitably burst. Well, it's useful to contemplate what's being done in the richest and most powerful country in human history, ours, and in the poorest country of South America. So in the U.S., Congress is taking the lead in undermining any hope for preventing catastrophe. And that, again, is driven by deeply rooted institutional factors, not bad people. Poorest country in South America is Bolivia. That's taken the lead internationally in efforts to protect the environment. Its most recent effort, just a couple of weeks ago, was to pass legislation granting rights to the natural world. Now, sophisticated Westerners can ridicule such naivete, but unless we can gain some of the sensibility of the indigenous majority in Bolivia, the last laugh may be on us. Well, all of this and a lot more can proceed as long as the Muasher Doctrine prevails, as long as the population is passive, apathetic, angry, diverted to consumerism, hatred of the vulnerable, and so on. As long as that remains true, then the powerful can do as they like. And those who survive can contemplate the ruins. But we all know that we don't have to obey the Muasher Doctrine. That's what we're here for now. We're here right now to celebrate 75 years of courageous refusal to do it, with many noteworthy successes. And they leave a legacy that we can carry forward, often been done in the past. It's being done right now in Tahrir Square and many other places under conditions far harsher than those that we face. So fortunately, the future is very much in our own hands.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.